This evening we want to conclude our study of the book of Psalms. I hope that it has been good for each and every one of us. It's good for us to take each one as it comes, and that's something that a lot of folks don't do, and there's certainly nothing wrong with skipping around or grouping Psalms together, but to take each one I think might be new for some, and it certainly is for me, and I'm enjoying going through each one in order. And we will conclude this evening, and then, Lord willing, sometime in the future we will pick up again with these Psalms. But we've been able to get up to Psalm 53, and I think that's good. Psalm 53 is the same as Psalm 14. And I wanted to say a few introductory remarks about that, and then I would like to read Psalm 14 again and have your hand there, where as soon as we get done reading Psalm 14, we can flip over and read Psalm 53. But Psalm 14 and Psalm 53 are similar in wording. They both talk about the fool who has said in his heart, there is no God. And so the folly of not having God in your life, it leads to a life of sin and wickedness. Both psalms are didactic, which means instruction psalms. They deal with the corrupt character and conduct of one who says there is no God. It is foolish to live without God and to live without seeking God. And the main reason is because it leads to a corrupt and wicked lifestyle. And we find that these ungodly people often will attack the people of God. The ungodly will attack the godly. The wicked will attack the righteous. But as we're going to see this evening, God will judge them. In contrast to the wicked, Psalm 53, verse 6, God will save his people Israel. So these two psalms are nearly identical. Now, that raises the question, why would you have something like that in the book of Psalms? We don't know. We're not given any information on that. But one suggestion may be that there were two copies of the same psalm with a little bit different wording because the occasion for it changed. And that brings me to my next point. When you read Psalm 14, the main difference is found in verse 5. And there's an emphasis there on God watching over the righteous. Whereas in Psalm 53, verse 5, there's an emphasis on God judging the wicked. And so there may have been an occasion where the people singing or the worship service wanted to focus on God protecting the righteous from these individuals. Whereas in Psalm 53, they wanted to emphasize God judging these wicked individuals who say there is no God. So that may be one reason for that. Before we read these two, in Psalm 53 it says, for the chief musician, and we've discussed that before, the person leading the music service of the worship service in the temple. And then it says, set to Mahalath. We don't know the exact meaning of some of these terms, but it may be a reference to a particular hymn that was called Mahalath, like the song America the Beautiful. It has a title to it. So this song may have been called Mahalath. Or it may be a musical instrument like a lute or a lyre has been suggested. But we don't know the exact meaning. But several of these terms that are in what we call the titles, they have to do with musical notations. Before the music begins, the people doing that would know what is involved in that. And then it says Maskil of David, and we studied that earlier with regard to Psalm 32, meaning an instruction psalm. Let's read together Psalm 14, and then we'll go right into Psalm 53. And notice in particular, when we get down to verse 5 of Psalm 14 and then verse 5 of Psalm 53, a little bit different concepts and wording there. Psalm 14:1, the fool hath said in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. They have done abominable works. There is none that doeth good. Jehovah looked down from heaven upon the children of men to see if there were any that did understand, that did seek after God. They all are gone aside. They are together become filthy. There is none that doeth good, no, not one. Have all the workers of iniquity no knowledge, who eat up my people as they eat bread, and call not upon Jehovah? There were they in great fear, for God is in the generation of the righteous. You put to shame the counsel of the poor, because Jehovah is his refuge. Oh, that the salvation of Israel were come out of Zion, when Jehovah bringeth back the captivity of his people. Then shall Jacob rejoice, and Israel shall be glad. Psalm 53, verse 1. The fool hath said in his heart, there is no God. Corrupt are they, and have done abominable iniquity. There is none that doeth good. God looked down from heaven upon the children of men to see if there were any that did understand, that did seek after God. Every one of them is gone back. They are together become filthy. There is none that doeth good, no, not one. Have the workers of iniquity no knowledge, who eat up my people as they eat bread, and call not upon God? There were they in great fear where no fear was. For God hath scattered the bones of him that encampeth against thee. Thou hast put them to shame, because God hath rejected them. Oh, that the salvation of Israel were come out of Zion, when God bringeth back the captivity of his people. Then shall Jacob rejoice, and Israel shall be glad. So notice in Psalm 53 and verse 5, God is going to scatter the bones of these wicked individuals. He's going to put them to shame. So there's an emphasis on judging these people. But if you look at Psalm 14 and verse 5 and 6, for God is in the generation of the righteous. There's an emphasis there on God protecting the righteous and helping them. And God is a refuge to the poor and those who put their trust in him. And so kind of contrasting ideas there. And that may be the reason for two psalms with similar wording. One occasion justified one particular thought, and the other one emphasized another thought. The other thing you may have noticed is that in Psalm 14, the description of deity is Jehovah. It's the Hebrew word Yahweh, meaning eternal one. So in Psalm 14, Jehovah is mentioned about four or five times or so there. But in Psalm 53, it's God every time, which is Elohim, meaning mighty one. And so again, just a little bit different emphasis on deity there. And we made this point before that what is called Book 2, starting at Psalm 42, that's where Book 2 starts. The main description that is used in Book 2 is God. The main description used in Book 1 is Jehovah. Okay? Let's look at our questions then this evening. The folly and wickedness of men. And when you have people that don't believe in God and have God in their life, it's going to lead to sinful actions. And we need to understand that a person can intellectually believe in God, but they still don't have God in their life. People who don't have God in their life, they may tell you, oh, I believe in God. And they may. But he's not a part of their life in any way, shape, or form. They're going to have a sinful life. And many of them are good in many ways. They may go to work and get their work done and pay their taxes and drive the speed limit and all that. But they have things going on in their life that is sinful. And they're not going to change that until they get God in their life in more than just an intellectual capacity, you know, where, yeah, I believe there's a God. They have to serve him. They have to obey him. They have to worship him. And so that's the kind of person that we're talking about this evening. Not a particular individual. Verse 1, the fool has said in his heart. He's not talking about, I have a particular fool in mind in Israel. He lives around the corner down on that street. He's not talking about an individual. He's talking about a class of people who don't have God in their lives. And this is what happens to them. Okay, Larry, we'll start with you this evening. Number one, what does the fool say and what kind of person is he who says it?
He says there's no God, and of course he is a fool and corrupt and does abominable things.
Exactly. That's why he's corrupt. He doesn't want to have God in his life. And one is going to lead to the other. Someone has said that ideas have consequences. Ideas have consequences. And if we have the idea that God is not going to be in my life, there's going to be a consequence to that. I'm going to live a corrupt life. You can't hold a belief and not have some consequence that goes with it. And so the consequence is they are corrupt, they're abominable, they're not doing any good. And so it's just foolish. And one reason it's foolish is because there is a God and there's evidence for God. And so it's just foolish to say there is no God. Now, this may be the outright atheist, the person who says, I don't believe that there is a God. It can also be the person who just doesn't want to have God in his life. Somebody might say, well, this psalm is not about me because I'm not an atheist. Well, it can be about you if you don't have God in your life. Number two, Matthew, what does God look down from heaven to see? Right. And, you know, what is he going to find? Now, I should have made mention of this in the notes. I might need to add it back in there, but if you look at verse 3, every one of them has gone back. They are together become filthy. That is hyperbole, just talking about how many people are like this. Obviously, there's exceptions. And the psalmist himself is an exception. The psalmist is not, this corrupt, abominable person who doesn't do any good. The psalmist is not some worker of iniquity. There are exceptions. There are righteous people. In fact, in Psalm 14, in the psalm that says everybody's living wickedly, verse 5 says that God comes down and takes care of the righteous. So there are people that are living right. So verse 3, everyone and so forth. This is an exaggeration to show how widespread this is. And how far it is, how pervasive it is in society. So he looks down to see if there's anyone that understands and that is seeking after God. And when he looks down today, he needs to be seeing us. He needs to see us seeking him and not the other way around. Okay, Janice, number three, what does God find when he looks down from heaven? Right, and that's the consequence of not having God in your life, and that's what we see in our society today. We have all kinds of war and bloodshed and crime and, scandal and all kinds of problems, and it's because people will not have God in their life. And societies will either rise or fall based upon their relationship with God. Okay, Mandy, number four, what do the workers of iniquity do? Right. And so my people, God's people, so these wicked individuals are persecuting righteous people. They are attacking them. And we've seen this in the Psalms. And so the wicked people attack the good people, and that still goes on. And they don't call upon God, which means worship God, serve God, obey God. They don't call upon him. In obedience to him. Okay. Number five, Claudette, how do the workers of iniquity react to God, and what does God do to them?
They react with great fear, for there is no fear, and God scatters their bones instead of being buried.
Okay. And again, this is at this point in the psalm is where it deviates in wording from Psalm 14. Psalm 14 at this point talks about that God is in the generation of the righteous, and that the Lord is the refuge of the poor. So that wording is a little bit different. Here, there's an emphasis on God is going to scatter in judgment these wicked individuals. So this is the major difference right here in the two Psalms. Okay, Mike, number 6, what does the psalmist cry out for, and what will Jacob or Israel do when the Lord saves them? Right. So it ends on a positive note that God will save his people. He's going to punish, verse 5, or judge the wicked, but he'll save his people. And we made mention of this last time that it would depend upon, you know, when this psalm was written and when it was used and that type of thing. It could have been used down toward the Babylonian captivity, but captivity can be used in the Old Testament to mean any kind of oppression happening in Israel. So bringeth back the captivity, verse 6, doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, the Assyrian captivity or the Babylonian captivity. It could be some other, problem that God's people are going through, even from a nation around them, Moab, Ammon, Edom, and being saved from that. Okay, so the folly of saying there is no God. There's just no reason to live like that. There's evidence in the Bible. There's evidence in the natural world that there is a God. And so anyone who wants to live a life without God is foolish. And that's a strong word. It's Nabal. It's someone who just will not think right, and they refuse to acknowledge God. I made mention in the notes that moral absolutes and divine accountability do not matter to them. I don't want to hear about right and wrong. Don't tell me about the Bible. Don't be preaching the Bible to me. That doesn't matter to them. And they live as if there is no God. God is not in their heart. So if we know of people like that, all we can do is try to convince them of the value, the importance, the blessing of having God in their life. Let's look at some applications. Eric, number 1, what happens when people refuse to have God in their life? Right. If you look at Romans 1 and 2 Timothy 3, it leads to sinful behavior, immoral conduct. But another thing that happens, what about the man in Luke 12 and verse 20? What was he an immoral person, the farmer? No, he wasn't an immoral person. What was his problem? Yeah, he just, you know, the things of this life, money, my things I can build. And at the very last verse there, it says, your soul is required of thee this night, and who shall these things be? He wasn't prepared to be in a right relationship with God. And so it wouldn't necessarily lead to just this gross immorality. That was Romans 1. It was homosexuality is listed there and all kinds of gross and, vile things. It can lead to that, or it can just lead to someone who is living, a pretty decent life, but God's not in their life. And, no Bible, no church, no plan of salvation, nothing. It's just my life, and I'm enjoying it. But when his day comes to die and meet God, he's not going to be prepared. So it's something to think about. It's foolish to keep God out of our life. And I made mention there is no good where there is no God. If we say, well, I don't want God in my life, well, there's not going to be any good in my life. And what one thinks about God will determine his character and his conduct. Okay, number 2. Joyce, according to Jesus, where does corrupt fruit come from?
From a bad tree.
Right, right. Corrupt are they, verse 1. Corrupt are they. And so we're going to bear the fruit on the outside of an inward character, a character without God. A character that doesn't want God in his life is going to produce corrupt fruit. Larry, according to Paul, what is corrupt? What is a corrupt mind lacking? Right, corrupt and bereft. The American Standard says bereft or without, lacking the truth. And so if we don't want God, God's word, truth, there's going to be a corrupt mind. We're going to fill it with something. If it's not filled with God's word, it's going to be filled with man's word, and that's going to be causing a problem. And if we wonder why is our society so corrupt, it's because God is not in the lives of individuals. Number three, Matthew, what solution to sin does sinful man have? Right, Paul talks about that all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, and there's this corrupt society, but there's hope, and that is justification by faith through Jesus Christ, Romans 3:23 and 24. So it's not hopeless. There is a plan of salvation for those who are corrupt, for those who are workers of iniquity, for those who are living in sin. They can be forgiven, but we have to come and obey Christ. Okay, Janice, number four, what does Paul say God wants? Yeah. And verse two, he's looking down from heaven to see if anyone is seeking after him. Are you? Am I? We need to be doing that. If the rest of the world is not, that's their business. We need to try to help them and teach them. But if somebody doesn't want to seek God, that's their choice. We're going to. We're going to make up our minds that we're going to do that. And our children are going to do that. That's what God wants us to seek him. And if haply we may find him. He wants to see if we love him. We want to obey him. We want to put forth some effort to come to him and know him. That's what he's looking for. And what does God do to those who seek him? Amanda? Yeah, he rewards those who seek him. And some versions say diligently seek him. So we need to be seeking God. And of course, we can seek him in the pages of his word. Claudette, what does Solomon say about when is it that a person goes astray? Is it when he's born or later?
He says that we're preparing
to right. And afterward, he goes astray, right?
He doesn't
right. Verse 3, every one of them has gone back. They are together, become filthy. There is none that doeth good. That's not because they were born that way. They chose that. We're born upright. And what I just read, Isaiah 53, verse 3, every one of them is gone back. They are together, become filthy. There is none that doeth good, no, not one. 53, 3.
Okay, so that's
yeah, I was just basing that point on verse 3. We see that wicked, sinful behavior, verses 1, 2, 3, 4. It's not because we're born that way. It's because we choose that later. Mike? Oh, did I say Isaiah 53? Psalm 53. It was supposed to be Psalm 53. Thank you. I'm sorry. Isaiah 53, I guess, is so popular that it was on my mind. But Psalm 53, verse 3. Thank you, Larry. Mike, number six, how does Peter describe the sin of Simon? Well, go ahead and take that Isaiah one. How does Isaiah describe Israel's sin? Right. And then how does Peter describe the sin of Simon? Right. And what I wanted us to get from that is that sin is filthy. Verse 3. Sin today among many is just viewed as no big deal. It's filthy. And I made mention in the notes, it's like it was a Hebrew word that was also used for stinking sour milk. You know, we don't want to, if you've ever smelled that, you don't just sit there and keep smelling it. It's gross. And sin is filthy. It's gross. And we need to remember that. And many people don't. If we would, maybe that we would do it less. and we would really want to get out of it. But people who don't think that it's all that bad, they just stay in it. And I wanted us to remember how the Bible describes sin. Number 7, Eric, what did the eunuch in the jailer's household do after they were baptized?
The Spirit of the Lord called Philip away so that the eunuch saw him no more. And the other one, that he rejoiced, having believed in God with all his household.
Right. The text says that they went on their way rejoicing, both of these individuals, and they were both saved from their sin. And so verse 6, he's praying for salvation, and that would lead Israel to rejoice. And so when we're saved from sin, it's a true opportunity to rejoice. Okay, good. Any comments or questions or observations there on Psalm 53? Okay. Well, let's sing that together. This is to the tune of A Charge I Have to Keep. So I'll sing. There is no God has said, the foolish in his heart. Corrupt are they, their works are vile, they all from good depart. Upon the sons of men, God looked from heaven abroad to see if any understood, if any sought for God. Together all are vile, they all are backward gone, and there is none that doeth good, no, not so much as one. Have men that evil work, no knowledge gained at all, who eat my people as their bread, and on God do not call. Great terror on them came, and they were much dismayed. Although there was no cause why they should be at all afraid. His bones to thee besieged, God hath dispersed abroad. Thou hast them put to shame because they were despised of God. Let Israel's help arise, from Zion God will bring. His captives Jacob shall rejoice, and Israel shall sing. Okay, thank you. With the time remaining, let's turn back to Psalm 45. We have just a few moments this evening to continue doing a review. Psalm 45 was the psalm, we called it a royal wedding song. This was the occasion of a king getting married. It may have been Solomon to one of his wives, we're not sure. But there is a description of the king, and then later the queen, verse 10, and the marriage ceremony down through 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, long in there. And so just a psalm, a royal wedding song, to celebrate the marriage of the king. It's called A Song of Loves. This is the psalm where verse 6 and 7 is quoted by the Hebrew writer and applied to Jesus. He is God. Psalm 46. God is our refuge. These types of psalms are really good to read when we are going through troubles and problems and trials in our life, and we need encouragement, and we can draw that from God. But God is our refuge. He's our protection in time of trouble, verses 1 through 3. He's a refuge in time of raging problems. He's a refuge in time of war. And so God is our refuge. It's a trust psalm. And we certainly need to put our trust in God in times of trouble, not just in good times, but in all times. God is our refuge and our strength, a very present help in trouble. So whatever that may be in our life, we need to come to God in trust, and then even praising Him. But the word refuge is used, verse 1, verse 7, verse 11, and so that's the theme of that psalm. People will turn to other things, riches, some turn to bad things, you know, drugs, alcohol, immorality, you know, they want to drown their sorrows in alcohol. We have troubles, we have problems in life, but we need to come to God with that, put our trust in God, and, you know, remain faithful to Him. So God is our refuge. Psalm 47. This would be a great psalm for the world to know about. God is King over all the earth. And, of course, we're losing that sense. But verse 7, God is the King over all the earth. It's a praise psalm. And God is praised from beginning to end. Verse 8, God reigneth over the nations. I wish we could understand that in our world today. World leaders get together, and many years ago there would be references to God, but not anymore. But God still reigns over the nations. And the more that we bring our lives into conformity to Him, the more the nation will prosper, but not until then. So God is King over all the earth. Psalm 48, the glory of Zion and the God of Zion. We discussed this psalm in verses 1 through 8, the city of God, and then verses 9 through 14, the God of the city. So Jerusalem itself is singled out as being a city that is beautiful to look at, but it's not just a physical place. There's a God who wants to put His presence there. So verses 9 through 14, the God of the city. That's really the important thing. Psalm 49. The folly of trusting in riches. And this is a psalm that would be important to remember today in our very affluent society. And we are well off. We've got to keep riches and money and things in its proper perspective. But after an introduction, what riches cannot buy, verses 5 through 12. Remember we studied that? It cannot buy what? It cannot keep you from doing what? It can't keep you from dying. So money cannot buy you a pass or a ticket away from death. We're going to die. And then where riches cannot go. We cannot take riches with us, right? So we don't need to be trusting in that. Those types of things are to be used in life as a servant, but not a master. They serve us. The Lord wants us to have money to take care of our things. Our family, or we have to live, food, shelter, clothing, and things. But when that's all that people have and nothing more, then they're going to live an empty life and they're going to die an empty life. God's not in their life. So we need to remember that type of thing. Verse 17, for when He dieth, He shall carry nothing away. The only thing we carry with us is our soul and whether or not it's in a right relationship with God or not. We're not going to carry any of that other stuff with us. So we need to be putting our emphasis on, you know, the things of the soul and not the things of the material realm. So it's a very good psalm for us today in our, you know, affluent world of riches and money and things. Psalm 50. God is the judge of the righteous and the wicked. He judges his people. And this whole psalm is almost like a courtroom setting where the judge calls forth to come together to be judged, verses 1 through 6. Then he gives the trial where all people are judged. And then he gives the sentence in verse 23. And the righteous will be saved and the wicked will be judged. So it's a reminder of what we read in the New Testament about we're all going to stand before the judgment seat of Christ. And so God is judge over all the world and he judges his people. How would we stand up to his judgment? That's what we need to be thinking about in our own lives. And if we need to make any changes, you know, let's do that. Okay? Psalm 51. This is the well-known psalm that may be a psalm of David after his sin with Bathsheba, but it's a penitent prayer for pardon. Lord, be merciful to me, wash me from my sin, and so forth. So it's a prayer for forgiveness of sin. It's petitioning God for forgiveness. And then turning around, starting in verse 12, after he's restored, he wants to go out and talk with others and tell them about how to be saved. And that's certainly a good attitude to have, and it's a good pattern to follow. Psalm 52, boasting in wickedness or trusting in God. So verse 1, we've got these people that boast in their mischief. And verse 7, they trust in their riches. But the contrast is, I trust in the loving kindness of God, verse 8. So we have a choice there. What is our boast? What is our glory? What is our trust? What do we talk about? What do we focus on in life? And that type of thing. So a number of these psalms really deal with things that are going on in our life and in our world today. And it would be good to go back and read them on a regular basis and meditate on those truths. And then, of course, tonight's psalm, the folly of not having God in your life. And it's just becoming more and more prevalent. There is a description that is being used today, the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, none. They're just nothing. They have none. They have no God in their life. And that is on the rise. Now, you have to be careful about some statistics. You know, sometimes, you know, you wonder exactly how they were brought about and so forth. But there's general study being done in interviewing people and so forth that there's a rise in people just being nothing. Secular. Not necessarily atheist. But not necessarily, you know, church going either. They're just nothing. They don't feel like they have to have any sort of church relationship. Read their Bible, pray. They're just nothing. They're not bad people going out committing crimes, but they're just nothing. And what's happening is parents who aren't a part of any church relationship or any sort of organized religion, they're raising children that way. They're not going anywhere. Their children are not going anywhere. And they're just, it's called the rise of the nuns. And it's increasing every year. And so what we're going to have in America is just a very secular society. I believe that that situation, it has problems with it. It also has prospects. And we can try to talk with those people and reach those people. But one of the problems is going to be, here's one of the main problems. If you have spent all of your life or a good part of it with no religion whatsoever in it, you really don't want to start. You stop and think about it. If you've spent all of your life never going to church one time on Sunday, do you want to start? No. You like your Sunday at the beach house or at the lake or at the golf course. You don't want to start going to church. You've never done that. And so it's got some problems to it. And I would say the biggest one is I don't want to start having to do the things I need to do as a Christian. I've never prayed for my food. I don't want to start doing that now. I've never read the Bible. I don't want to start that now. I've never gone to church. The biggest one is going to be using the Lord's Day for the Lord. That's going to be the biggest problem, and people aren't going to want to do that. On the flip side, that's the problem area. The prospect area is that because they're nothing, in some sense they're like a clean slate. And you can reach them with the truth. You can reach them with the gospel. You don't have to undo Islam. You don't have to undo Mormonism. You don't have to undo a bunch of stuff that was, hammered in them all through life. So that's the prospect. So problems and prospects. But there are more and more people, as I understand it, who are just nothing. And God's not a part of their life. And so that's something to think about with our own lives and our own children. And something to think about as we try to talk with others. I'll close with that.